We turn therefore to the second chapter of Esther for our meditation tonight. And the great general theme of this book of Esther is, of course, the providence of God. It's along with the book of Song of Solomon, the two books where there is no reference, clear reference at least, to the name of God. And along with the book of Ruth, it's the two books that have a female title to them. What we have here in this few opening chapters is what can best be represented as long-term strategic planning. Sounds almost something out of NATO. Long-term strategic planning. That's a great quality for those or in those that have it. But sometimes it's a quality that can be misunderstood. But let me take it down to an example or two examples which we can more easily relate to. Long-term Christian strategy. Let me think of snooker. Snooker, you're potting reds and then you're potting coloured balls. And one of the qualities of a great snooker player is to place the white ball ready for the next pot. Perhaps we would be quite pleased if we simply got one down in one of the corner pockets. But they think ahead, long-term strategic planning, to get the white ball where it is. And sometimes when you see it, you've got to ask yourself the question, why did he put it there? Why there? And the significance of the placement runs several shots ahead, so they can get that one, and that one, and then that one. Strategic planning, snooker. Same thing, strategic planning, not only in snooker, but with a spy master. The Cold War has passed. The age of spies is not as high on the agenda as it once was, but a spy master, he engaged in the same thing. He placed his assets, be it a sleeper or a mole, he placed his assets long term, ready for use when they were needed. Long-term strategic planning. And if we take that simple theme of long-term strategic planning, we have a handle to understand something of the doctrine of providence and what God is doing in the book of Esther. We know what the end is, and therefore we can understand the things that are happening here. We make sense of it, but those who are actually in it, they're not able to make sense of it just the same way as we do. There were problems for Esther, there were problems for Mordecai along the road. Why is this happening, and why now, and why in this way? The questions that would pile up, even as we've got them in our singing of Psalms earlier on tonight. Why? And the answer comes back to the echo. The providence, the planning, the purpose of God. There was a problem going to come upon God's people. One of the main characters, Haman, he was going to raise a scheme for his own enrichment in the destruction of the Jewish people. That's what the threat was. We'll come to it later on in our studies. But the Lord was now putting in place a protection against that eventuality. We've moved on from chapter 1 into chapter 2. And we've moved on 4 years. Chapter 1 we saw, just to characterize it, it was a domestic. That's the way the police would call it today. There was a domestic between a husband and a wife. Okay, they were king and queen, but it was still the same. They fell out. They had an argument. A domestic. It was serious and it was big time. But that's where the providence of God starts. With an empty place. With a situation vacant. The providence of God, His good, kind and unceasing activity, controlling things that would work out for the good of His people, according as He has decided and resolved it to be. He singles out His people, every one of His children. He singles out you and me, as if there's no one else. And nothing escapes His notice. And nothing happens without His permission. Providence in the book of Esther. In the lives of these people. And here we move into chapter 2. And we see and have rich lessons that show to us the variety of providences and help us to understand them, that we might read our own life with more of a degree of understanding and appreciation. I want to break down this chapter into 4 or 5 sections and paragraphs. Let's begin with the first one. We have here interruptions. Then we have applications. Then we have introductions. Preparations. And so the end. But we come back to the beginning. The first thing I want us to think about are interruptions. After the removal of Vashti the queen in chapter 1, like I said, 4 years have passed. In these 4 years, there was no time to fill the space. Situation vacant hung on the palace door for 4 years. God had started His providential work, but then there seemed to be a pause. How long, Lord? Why? These 4 years, or a most part of them, was taken up, if you go back to secular history, with the Persian and Greek wars. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, he had a mighty army, and we saw last week the way in which his kingdom extended from the borders of India, Pakistan, right over to the country of Ethiopia and everything in between. The sun never sat on the British Empire. Well, the same almost could be said for the rule and reign of Ahasuerus. A vast area. And he was going to make fight with the Greeks. The year was 480. The Battle of Salamis. The Battle of Thermopylae. 300 Spartans involved in the battle. There we have Xerxes demanding from the Greeks and all the Greek states submission to his rule. But the Greeks refused to give it. And so Xerxes gathers together a huge army from all of that kingdom, from Asia, from India, from the corner of Africa, and he set out against the Greeks. One of the secular writers speaks about this army on the move, that wherever they came to a stream, apart from the big, big streams and rivers of that land, whenever they came to a stream, such was the number of men that they would drink the stream dry almost. He started out with great victories, but eventually he ended with crowning defeats. Now then, why? Why is the minister taking so much time to talk about something in secular history, the Persian-Greek wars? What's the significance of that for the book of Esther? Why is it so important? It's important because of this. That Greek war addresses the question with ourselves of the timing of events. Why do things happen when they do? Why do they not happen when we want them to happen? We often want things to happen right away, immediately, isn't soon enough. And we cannot cope, or we find it difficult to cope with any kind of delay, any kind of interruption. But that's what we've got here for the best part of 4 years. Interruptions, delays. Yes, it develops our character as Christians. God tests us how much we want something. So there's a lesson of persistence and perseverance in these delays. But there is also a lesson of God's providence in these interruptions. Perhaps in prayer or with a promise of God's word, we're waiting for an answer to something that's important to us. Nothing is coming. And the question why begins to feature more and more on our horizon. Delay breeds doubt. But there's a reason behind it. And when you get to the end of chapter 2, you begin to realize there was a plot to kill the king. Mordecai got to know about it, told Esther. Esther told the king, and the king was saved. And careful note was made of that very thing. It was a crucial, critical event. At the time, it didn't seem to be all that significant. But it was a crucial event later on in the unfolding of God's providence. And here we have an explanation why there was an interruption, why there was a delay. God has not forgotten. God has not passed over us. God is not in any way unable or unwilling to answer his promises or our prayers. Instead, we have this. That development, that answer that we're waiting for, that involves us passionately, that answer and development has an influence, or is tied into much, much bigger and far-reaching event in the perfect wisdom of God. Delays? We wait for the perfect timing of God. Not our time, but God's time. So here the first thing we have is interruption, delay, addressed by Esther. But we move on and we think of the second thing that is given to us here in the book of Esther, applications. Xerxes returned from battle, and we can imagine how he returned. He was defeated, he was routed, he was down in spirit, we can understand why. And he missed female company to lift his spirit. And we're told in the very first verse here, he remembered what Vashti had done and what had happened to her. And the way in which she had been removed. And especially at the very end of that first verse, and what was decreed against her, the verb in the Hebrew is passive. It's not what he did against her, it's what was done to her. In other words, Xerxes is beginning to put a little bit of clear water between himself and this decision that after all his counselors gave him. And it's almost as if he's beginning to blame them for what's happened to her, and how he's alone, and how he's needing some company. And so therefore you find these counselors coming up with this scheme for their own survival and their own protection. Let's find a replacement. A young, a beautiful virgin. It's open to all. They can be prepared for the best part of a year, and then presented to the king. Now that's not the normal way of finding a queen replacement in the days of Persia. The way it was done was normally that they would take one from the choicest of the families of Persia. The nobility of the land, after all, was trained and bred for this very purpose of providing a king, a queen for a king. That's the way they thought. And the Lord guided these people, these counselors, to depart from convention and to come up with this suggested plan. The book of Proverbs tells us this. A man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps. Same thing is said in chapter 21 and verse 1. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. The work of the heart and the minds of people, the king, his counselors, and ordinary folks, all of them are in the hand of the Lord. And so therefore this plan that was conceived and shared with the king, here is the mind of these people being guided by the providence of God to come up with this scheme that would ensure that Esther was not cut out of the equation. That she wasn't debarred or handicapped. But she was there brought in the broad scheme and sweep of all the eligible women coming to the house and the harem of the king. Applications. Sometimes we can feel exposed and vulnerable. Sometimes advice is given to us, just the same as advice was here given to the king. Sometimes this advice is given to us and we're asking the question, well, why was I told that? Why was I given that kind of advice? And only looking back can we acknowledge the providence of God, the way in which it's brought blessing upon us. We don't understand it at the time, and let's remember that we've got the gift they didn't have. We know the end, they don't. But we can look back down the valley of our days and we can see the way in which, yes, that's why. Now I see it. That's why I was told that. That's why somebody said that to me. The hand of the Lord working in that person, bringing their path to cross mine and in their mouth to speak a word to me. Now I see it. God's providence working in these counselors and the way they spoke to the king. Interruptions. Applications. We move on and we see here an introduction. There is a break at verse 5. You can almost imagine verse 4 and verse 8 running together. But suddenly, there comes a break. There's a break in the story and in the natural run of the narrative. And we're introduced to two key players. And there is an abrupt interruption. And there is an abrupt introduction. The loss is not, the emphasis is not there at all in the English translations before us. But the way in which it comes across in the original is very stark and to the point. A man. A Jew. That's what comes across. We're confronted with a man. A Jew. Who is he? He's Mordecai. And notice what's given. We're given his lineage. We're told 1, 2, 3 generations back. And we're told that that generations that far back, they were taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar. We're given a reason why Mordecai is now introduced to us. Why are we meeting him? Because away back over the years, at a great distance from Persia, God saw to it in providence that his forefathers were brought into the land, so that Mordecai was there then, at that moment, for use in God's providence. Decisions and events that happened so long ago brought Mordecai there at that time, at that place. An introduction to Mordecai. So I ask the question, why are you here tonight? Why are you here tonight? Ask the question of Mordecai. Why are you there? He's there because the Lord was working so far back in his life. Very well. Ask the question of ourselves. Why are you here tonight? And for a moment, just recall the crucial decisions that were made by yourself and by others that results in you being here now. And if you gather all these providences together, you begin to create a magnificent picture of the unique opportunity that God has created and generated for you tonight as we gather together, you and me, here in God's house. We are here as he has planned and brought it to pass. Let me just throw the text and the example and the episode at you. You can look at it in your own time. But if you go back to Acts chapter 10 and verse 33, you find there the extension of the gospel into the Gentile nations done by Peter. And Cornelius there, he's guided by God to send a delegation to take Peter to give them the message. And Peter at the same time is given an encouragement and the vision to go when the invitation comes. The providence of God bringing both parties together that they might, and the word that is said, we're all here gathered. We are all here gathered to hear what God has to say to us from you. A unique opportunity to hear the gospel. And the seriousness of that opportunity is increased by the providence that brings it about. Just think back. The providences that have brought us together here and the seriousness of these providences intensifies the privilege. So many decisions boxing us into this service. The introduction and the lesson from the providence of Mordecai. But not only are we introduced to Mordecai, we're also introduced to Esther. Esther, she lost both her parents. She was a beauty. She had charm. She was attractive. She was a Jew. She didn't have any high standing. She wasn't one of the families, the notable families of Persia. She didn't have any backers pushing her cause or her position. She wasn't born with a silver spoon in her mouth. But she had good looks when good looks were sought after. That's what God gave her and bestowed upon her. The Lord gives to each what can be used in his service. And what was given to Esther was what was required on her and from her. The good looks that would promote her to the place of influence that was required of her to save the people. Introduction. Sometimes we talk to ourselves, and sometimes we are actually talking to God. And we say things like this, Lord, If only I had a sharper mind. Lord, if only I was like so-and-so. Lord, if only I could speak better. Lord, why am I this way? We are what we are because that's the way the Lord has made us. And if we wish to be different, I venture to suggest that we're offending Him. Psalm 139:13 tells us that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And if we were to read ourselves in the light of Psalm 139, we would realize just exactly why we are what we are. With every one of us, every one of us has a contribution to make according to our character, constitution, composition. Let's find it and make it. Esther was given beauty because at that day and in these times, beauty was required. God has made me and made you where we are to be used in His service where He's put us. Introductions. But what else? We have interruptions, applications, introductions. Then we have preparations. The edict went out and the women came in. Esther included. Can you imagine, therefore, the pressure there was in the harem when 400 women got together? That's what we're told by Josephus. 400 women came through the preliminary screening. And there would have been a cutthroat attitude there. After all, what was at risk? The throne of the queen. Everyone was out for themselves. And there is Esther in the midst of that kind of pressure situation. 12 months of beauty. 12 months of food. Everything to tune up the body and to make it shine in its most attractive. But we all know, don't we? Beauty, it's only skin deep. Character is far more important. And if the character is in, the character will come out. And so we find that Esther, beauty as she was, she had that character. Because we're finding out that she gained the favour of the eunuch. The one in charge. Look at verse 9. And the maiden pleased him. She found favour with Haggai. And she obtained kindness from him. How did that happen? How did that favour come about? Remember another study we had just recently in the life of Joseph. And Genesis chapter 39 and verse 21 where we read this. A very similar situation. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. And gave him favour in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Is that not an echo of what happened to Esther in the harem of the king? There she found favour as Joseph found favour. And how was it brought about with Joseph? We are told there the Lord was with him. And we can therefore conclude that the Lord was with her. The preparations, the Lord preparing for what was going to come. There was, just to summarize it quickly, there was an advance in her treatment. We're told that this man, the eunuch, gave to Esther advance first call on the treatment. Gave to Esther 7 of the best beauticians of the land. Gave to Esther the best place in the whole of the structure of the harem. She was given favour lavished upon her. The preparation that was put upon her was remarkable. She had favour. Now, seeking favour, let's say this right away, seeking favour to advance our cause is very, very dangerous. Dangerous because it can often involve compromise of our position. How is Esther going to succeed with so many round about her chasing after this one throne? How is Esther going to succeed with so little to help her? The rest of them had their entourage with them, their mothers, their grandfathers, their granddaughters, their grandmothers rather, everybody pandering to them, making sure that they were shining at their best. How was Esther going to cope with all of that? Perhaps, therefore, she needed help herself. But no. We find here something quite remarkable, that the Lord was already ahead of her. The Lord was already ahead, making preparation and provision for her. The same thing can be said, our time is going, but let me just simply put the example. Nehemiah in chapter 1 verses 10 and 11. The news came to him about the fall and the ruins of Jerusalem. And he was concerned about what to do about it. And he was prepared to go. But he was, after all, the cupbearer to the king. And therefore he prayed that the Lord would in some way, he didn't know how, but he prayed that the Lord would favorably dispose the king towards the plight that he carried in his soul. And when he went before the king, he was downcast. And the king noticed it. And therefore they engaged in conversation. And through that providence, Nehemiah was allowed to go. The favor was shown to him without compromise because God had gone ahead in the situation. Preparation. There are sometimes situations for ourselves where we feel uncomfortable, intimidated. We feel in a degree apprehensive. Oh yes, it's God's way, it's God's will for us. And what do we find? The old writer spoke about prevenient grace. Simply means God going ahead. God going ahead, he's there before us, making preparation for us, diffusing the danger and the threat and the uncertainty for us, giving us therefore confidence in his way. The prevenient grace of God meeting the sinner. He goes ahead of us down the road of life, and he's waiting there with a providence, waiting with a providence to turn us into the path that he wants us to take. The preparations, we see them here. Yes, what about the preparation that was given through the good advice of Mordecai? Mordecai said to Esther, don't reveal your roots. Don't tell them who you are. Was this right? Is this morally correct? And we meet people, don't we? Some people, and they're all over us. We can hardly get in a word in edgeways. The first 5 minutes of the conversation when we meet them, they tell us everything there is to know about them. They gush us and they fill us and they flatter us with everything that needs to be told. But Mordecai says to Esther, don't be like that. Matthew Henry draws out a very simple difference. He says, the difference between telling a lie and hiding the truth. Don't tell who you are. It may create unnecessary obstacles. In the providence of God, it gives an open door. Don't close it. It was also a way of drawing out the hostility of Haman to disarm him. Don't reveal your roots. Simple illustration I can think of like this. You're in a discussion. A minister's in a discussion. A Christian's in a discussion. And it's about spiritual or Christian things. And it's going around and you put in your own contribution. But you don't let it be known who you are. you just simply make known your position. Because if you were to say, yes, but I'm the so-and-so minister, or I'm such and such a believer, immediately down would come the curtain, the door would slam in your face, and the opportunity would be gone. Don't reveal your roots if you don't have to, so that the door of opportunity is there for you to speak. The advice given by Mordecai. But not only that, but we read here that advice was also given by Haman, was also given by Haggai. We are told that she went in and she took with her just what he told her to take, except and only what he told her to take. There was no obligation upon him to do this. There was no obligation whatsoever to tell her anything. Verse 15. She was come to go unto the king. She required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the woman, appointed. Advice given by the man who was looking after them, preparing her to meet the king. We're not told what the advice was. And we've got to be careful lest we brand Esther guilty of adultery. There is no indication here whatsoever of that behavior as there was with the others who were before her in the queue. Instead, there's something else at work that we've already hinted at. We saw in verse 9, did we not, the favor that Haggai showed towards her. But that wasn't limited to the eunuch in charge of the harem. It spreads out, the charm of this woman. Go down to verse 15. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. And it wasn't limited to all them, it was also the very experience of the king himself at verse 17. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head. Again, the God of providence ahead, preparing the way. No compromise to reach the way of the Lord, but instead confirmation of the will of the Lord. The preparation. We pause to gather together so much of the strands of providence, preparing for this woman to go. One last thought. I know time is going, but let me just take it in 2 minutes. The obligations. And these obligations come out of the last 3 or 4 verses. After the queen was in place, after Esther was in place, perhaps she saw to it, to the promotion of Mordecai into public office. And in that public office, he came to know about a plot to kill the king. He told Esther, Esther told the king, and the king was delivered. And it was written in history. The nation of the Persians were renowned for their great record keeping. They would write and take a note of everything. And the king, we're told, saw it. It was done, the very last words, it was done before the king. It was written down on a scroll. It was rolled together and was put in a shelf, in a cupboard, in a room, away from the living quarters of the palace. The illustration I can best think of is these Russian dolls. One inside the other, inside the other, inside the other. That's the way this scroll was put away. A small thing at the time, with no obvious consequences whatsoever. But later, it would loom large in events. But just think of it. In all of the history of that nation, in all of the archives, with all of the scrolls and everything else, what chance is there that that very scroll was going to be picked up and read again when the king couldn't sleep and he wanted something to read. What's the chances of that happening? All of the pieces were in place, but the opportunity was so remote. But that very remoteness highlights the theme of the book of Esther, the providence of God. His intervention in a specific way to bring about his intentions. Between the king and Mordecai, there now stands something that we can just put in a very simple, cliched way. You owe me. You owe me. And it was going to be repaid in a remarkable way. Providence. Seen and expressed in so many different ways. Meeting us at so many different times and so many different places. Displaying the interest and the detail of God in his people. Sometimes it's difficult to read the book of Providence. But we can do it with care if we see and follow the example of the character of Esther. Her humility, her obedience, and her willingness to be taught and to take on board advice that she was given. The wonder of God's preparation and putting in place the people for the preservation of his people when danger threatens. That's God's providence on this scale. But it's on the same scale sometimes in our lives. And when we see his providence, we turn aside to worship him. Let us therefore pray. O Lord our God, help us to make sense of thy word. Help us to understand it in its plainest and simplest of teaching. Break it down to us, O Lord, that all of the difficulties and all of the inabilities in us can be overcome so that we can see the beauty and the wonder of these simple truths given for the comfort and the encouragement of thine own children upon the earth. Bless thy word as we've been exposed to it today. Forgive us our sins and the high privileges of worship. And remain with us as we part one from the other. And may thy truth be constantly our delight and influence in our living. In Jesus' name we ask it. Amen. We close by singing from Psalm 16 tonight at verse 6. Psalm 16 and at verse 6. Unto me happily the lines and pleasant places fell. Yea, the inheritance I got in beauty doth excel. I bless the Lord because he doth by counsel me conduct. And in the seasons of the night my reins do me instruct. Before me still the Lord I set. Sith it is so that he doth ever stand at my right hand, I shall not move be. Because of this my heart is glad and joy shall be expressed, even by my glory and my flesh in confidence shall rest. 16 then, verses 6 through 9, four stanzas. Unto me happily the lines and pleasant places fell.